I ran out of wind, shut it off.
Name of the boat?
The boat's the name of the Yugak.
Okay.
Used to be Alaska Booth Fisheries Karlick Tug. And then when Alaska Packers bought out Booth Fisheries, it was on the ways at Harvester Island. And Harry Howe traded 5,000 feet of lumber for it. They had an old Frisco Standard gas engine. Smooth run boat, made 9 knots on a big old three-cylinder engine.
Wow.
Gas engine. And so I took over the logging, and I had to use that boat to tow the... We logged on Big Raspberry Island. I towed them to the mill over by Port Bailey. Anyhow, I used to run it alone. I come to town and got a bunch of stuff and went back that night in September 28th. Raining and black, and I had to stop at the camp, and I missed by about 50 feet in the end of a reef over by Big Raspberry Island. I just hit the end of the reef, doing 9 knots on the fair tide.
Yeah.
The boat reared up in the air and went over, come on her side, straightened up and went chug, chug, going down. But the water was pouring in. I was towing a big skiff. I tried to get around Raspberry Island to find a beach in the dark. And finally it flooded the engine room till the engine quit. But I got all the groceries off and everything in this big skiff, grabbed my tow line, tied the buoy in the middle of the tow line, just gab line, I couldn't tell where, tied this buoy we had on deck, threw it and just jumped in the skiff when the deck was awash and started rolling for home. The boat went down. And it took us a week to find it.
What year was this?
38.
Once you found it, what'd you do with it?
And I couldn't figure why I couldn't find that buoy, you know. I knew it was underwater. Finally found it off the end of Whale Island. The tide had taken it.
The whole boat.
And it, minus tide, the buoy just showed for about an hour, and then the tide would carry on. The boat was 43 feet under, and minus tide. So I took that fufu, and the flat barge, and the stanchions on the barge like this. And I took a cable and went up, tied one end and went up, and no, I took it from this end, went up like this, dug it around till it hung up on the boat and put it up tight and fast it. Then I started this end with another cable, went up around, so I had it scooped both ways.
Right.
Took it. Then when the tide came in, it lifted the boat off the bottom. See, it come under the bow and under the stern.
Right.
It just happened. I didn't know which way it was, but that's the way it did. But I figured the way the tide run, the way it lay on the bottom would be endo. It turned out it was right. Just one other fellow and I. It took us 13 days. And each tide we'd move it up a little bit. And then we had another boat give us a hand. We towed it across the lagoon on Raspberry Island. And the tide went out like that. And then we moved it up a little bit until it went completely dry. And it was just, didn't only hold it, split the shaft log up at the stern. We corked that up and the boat floated up fine. 4 to 5 days later, we had the old engine running again and went back in service.
So you didn't lose the boat, it just...
No.
Wow. What happened to the boat? What finally...
Well, after I left Harry's partnership, went to sleep right in the channel in town, and the Mini B, you've seen the old boat Mini B?
Yeah.
KDX?
Yep.
Cut him in two, hit it right in here and cut him clear into the tow bit. Shoved him up on the beach. They got it going again, and then he changed engines in it, and the boat and his family, and he went to Astoria, Oregon, moved down there, and it was sold to some Dungeness crab fishermen, and they sank it down there, and years later showed up here, the painters had it, fished it, I don't know what frame of work came in there, but Louis Lohenberg, he fished on deck of it one time.
Really?
And eventually, after I retired, I was down here in King Crab Dock, I was first in paddleboards, and I was sitting in the office with Pete DeVoe, the superintendent, and the fire siren blew. I said, "Hey, there's a fire someplace." Pretty soon, the fire wagon coming right out on the dock and went, "Pete, the love of Pete, we got a fire in the cannery." And we ran out on the dock, and here come the UYAK headed for the dock. Smoke pouring off. The fire was coming from the wagon. And they got the fire out. And a few years later, it sank at Cape Chiniac. It's on the bottom out there now. So that's four times I know it's been sent. But it was a tough old boat.
Yeah, she was a beaut.
There's an article or two about it. I have papers, the newspaper about it. I've got a lot of stuff saved up.
Yeah, I'd like to look through that. So she finally went down. But you didn't, you sold her to, you must have sold her to somebody. You owned it and then you sold it.
Well,
or your partner owned it.
When I split a partnership with Harry Holloway, he got that.
Oh, I see. Okay. Then you had the Rosemary after that then.
And I didn't buy the Rosemary until 58. That was in 39 when I sank it.
So that was your first boat up here?
That's the first boat I ran.
Right, and then you had that little, the other boat.
I started running that in 38.
Right. You had, and this little white one, you ran that little white one too, huh?
The first boat outside I owned was I've got a picture of all the boats I owned. Okay. I had the little one, the Gertie, with all the fish in.
Yeah, you showed me. It's one next to the bridge. Is that, which boat?
That's the Fog Neck River, Lake Nick.
Right, and the boat,
boat? That's the little one I fished on.
I see.
They're just the same size as my own that I had a year later.
Okay. Okay. And which?
That's the Fufu alongside the barge raising the U-Yak. You want to ride on the back of it?
Is this the Fufu?
And that's the lower sea.
Okay. And this is the boat you had built, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I see.
You're right on.
Okay, and this is the lowest sea.
You better shut that off. That when you want it.
Go ahead.
I'll tell you anyhow, and then I'll get a case. But when I was about 6 months old, my folks separated. My grandparents raised me until I was three, and then my dad married again. And we lived at the Y then until 1928, and then we moved into Shelton. So for 10 or 12 years, while I lived right there, my grandfather's ranch is right next to the Y. Anyhow, what the Y was is a railroad track comes from Shelton. Railroad track went right on by the Y like this, but right here, it branched off and curved up like that, and then it come back like this and tied into the main line. So the Lokis from town would come up with empties, come up here, and back them up this way to the siding, then they'd hook onto the logs and logs, and they pointed back towards town as a turnaround. And in between that those tracks, that's why they called it the Y, and a fellow named Friskin was the superintendent of the camp. It wasn't a camp anymore, but it was all the main machine shops for Simpson Log Company. They rebuilt the locomotives and had the big shops and roundhouse and all supplies and kept the Lokis there and the sand house. And all the houses are built just against the track on the outside of the track. And the camp and the building was in the middle. So we used to play through all that stuff. My dad was a master machinist for 22 years for him. And so that's why we lived there. And I used to go in the shop for the building railroad, the wheels for the locomotives and putting the tires on. And then here on up the line, eventually it was Camp 5, and that's where I worked there for 33 to 37.
That was right before you came here then?
Pardon?
Right before you came to Alaska?
That was before I came up.
Right.
I left there in 37, came up here. This is an old Camp 5 before the one where I worked in.
Oh, I see.
This is another logging camp. See, these houses, they all can move them on a flat car and move them. Slide them onto a flat car and move them to a new location. These are the bunk houses. This was before my time, though. But when I went in the camp, we had only 8 men on a side. I don't know how many you got here. But this had to be an old one. Here's the locomotives. There's push cars, rails, logs. I'll show you some of the equipment I worked on. Usually had an engine run through an old bridge. I used to go there to play baseball when I was a kid.
Where's there? What's that?
That's Satsop, Washington.
I see.
This is where they dumped the logs at Shelton in the early days. It's the town was all built up around there after that. Camp 1, 1918-1929. I remember this camp. I used to hike over there from where we lived. Some of my boyfriends who went to school, I'd hike across about 6-7 miles away. There was nothing to walk those days.
Yeah, not a lot of TV or anything.
This was Camp 2, Camp 3. I never was up at the Camp 3 until after they quit logging. And Camp 4, and this is Camp 5. This is the way it looked like when I lived there. You can't see the bunkhouses and stuff. There's a better picture someplace. Here's Camp 5. When I stayed in camp, I stayed in one of these bunkhouses.
Boy, pretty desolate.
Yeah. See, the whole camp and all these offices, bunkhouses and mess halls...
They're all on tracks.
They're all on tracks. Because whenever they logged an area, they moved to another one, they just moved the camp.
That's a good idea.
And these houses are all built so they could lift them up and slide them on and take them too.
Wow.
Old Camp 7.
Logging operation there.
This is a big logging outfit.
Well, I guess.
I knew this guy well. He raised bees. Archie Adams. There are 3 Adams boys and they're all scalers. One was a head scaler for Wallace Simpson. And the other, and he's... worked under his brother Sam, and this one did too. I don't know that guy. This here was a cook. I can remember him as a kid for years and years. He was head cooking for Simpson. And that's the superintendent, Clay Berry, and his daughter Louise. We went to school together.
And she's pretty.
She's living right next to my mother. I talked to her a few minutes on the phone, but she was... Her husband was going someplace last time I was down, so I didn't get to talk with her. Water tank with a fill of Lokis. This is the one that I fired for about about a year, because they knew me from one outfit to another, and then they fired donkeys like this too. But this is a big unit.
Yeah, that's real big. Now, a donkey is a belt.
This is the one we call the yarder or donkey. It's on the big wood skids. These are about 6 foot two, the skids that are on. They used to take them right across country, right down off the bluffs and across the river and up to another shore.
Pretty sturdy.
I knew a lot of these people at the time. Took two engineers and one fireman. Here's Tom Kelly. I knew him when I was a little kid. He used to whittle and make all kinds of stuff, and fans for the kids and slingshots. He worked for him for 50 years. Simpson said it was a good outfit to work for.
Oh, it looks like it.
Look at these logs.
Look at the size of those.
Yeah.
It's been seven feet wide,
When I was working on a big yarder, I helped load a log like that. It was 9 foot through on the small end and 11 on the other end.
Are these redwoods or just regular?
I just picked it up and laid it on the flat car.
Boy, monster trees.
I like that. Yeah. They were a tough bunch.
I'll tell you. Now, what's this?
That's a trestle they built across the river.
Why?
And as long, I seen this, they were through logging on across the Wainuchi at the time I worked at Camp 5, so they didn't use this trestle anymore. But they later on, they made a movie, Ring of Fire, and Clark Gable was the main actor.
Yeah.
And they burnt this bridge with two cars and a locomotive on it, let it drop into the river 300 feet down there. Now, these are locomotives that I'm all acquainted with, it, old 7 spot. And this one I've rode, and I was riding on this one when they backed up through a switch and one half went one way and the other went the other and broke the drive shaft in two. This is a Shay. This one's just, maybe this is a Shay. Now this is a Shay because the pistons run up and down and they crank the shaft. This is a climaxer on an angle. I remember that engine well. I fired it a lot. Here's the guys bucking logs by hand. Cooks. I missed some locomotives someplace. A 6 spot. They moved Camp 5 up to Camp Grisdale. This is the last logging camp that Simpson Logging Company had. And they sold this out, I think it was about how many millions and millions and millions of dollars. They sold at auction. And their equipment went all around the world. Some went to Africa, some went to Asia, South America.
How come they sold out?
They was logged up as high in the mountains, they didn't pay to log the mountains anymore. And they're in the National Forest Reserve. And this was the new camp they laid out. Schoolhouse, family houses, and stores. Look how long the saw is.
Boy, that must have really been a workout. Working those bow saws like that.
Here they're moving the donkey here. See how they're built? You got the lines out, he's got the line running out, they're moving it. 1950. That might have been one that I worked on or fired, I don't know. There's a guy who just cut the top off a tree.
That's what you used to do, right?
I did it for my own self when I was logging on the fog neck. I never did in there. This is 200 some feet high.
A little high for me. Yeah.
See how they top them off, all the rigging hanging on. I don't think I told you when we were talking yesterday that my folks were separated and I was raised by my grandparents.
No.
For a while. Until my dad got married again when I was 2.5 or 3 years old. And then they had one girl. So I have a half-sister still living. She's in that picture I showed you on the ring, Margaret.
Right.
And I had one full brother who's long passed. And after they got married, well, we moved into the logging camp for 10, 12 years. And I used to walk to school. The school was in my grandfather's field about a mile away. And there was 12 or 13 kids in school, but they had 12 grades. A lot of grades didn't have anybody in them. So I went the first 4 years in that school. And then later they consolidated and I went to a bigger school and then I wound up high school in Shelton. And when I was 17, I quit school. Seemed like one guy and I didn't get along in the classroom. After I came up here, and then I told you I was married first to Laura Larson. And then I eventually married Ann Nomoff.
And that's your wife now, Ann?
That's the wife now. And she had two children. I adopted them. And then we had six more. And the oldest one was a girl, Virginia. And she lives in Seattle. And her husband, Walt, had just died here a couple months ago now. See, time goes fast.
Boy, it does.
And the next one was Howard. It's here. It's with the Native Corporation all these years. Runs a computer system and takes care of all our logging setup. And travels all over the country for the company. He just got home again a couple of days ago. And then the next one was twins, a boy and a girl. Jerry and Tessie. And Tessie died in 79. She's in Denver. Jerry is living at Wasilla. He's married, living up in Wasilla. And then let's see who's next. Perry is after that, the one that's home, and then Carol Ann, you know her.
Yep.
She's the youngest. And Danny and May were the two of Ann's children that I adopted. And Danny's here in town right now. In fact, he's working loading ship in Danger Bay. And May died a year ago last July, 94. And I've lost track of how many grandchildren there is. I know there's some great-grandchildren. The girls did pretty good, but the boys didn't do much.
Yep.
Then I'll skip back to one of the first real jobs I had after I got out of school was driving a delivery truck for a meat and ice company, a grocery store. A fellow named Jack Bixel owned it. I became his personal driver, and I used to haul his women to his parties. He owned a lot of rentals. I collected rent for him. I delivered. I hauled the whiskey from the state liquor store for him. I was my own boss, really. I used to go to haul his cash to the bank for him and everything. I was just a kid. I could do anything I wanted to practically. He hated to see me quit, but I wouldn't work in the store. And of course, I did a lot of other things. When I went to school, I raised chickens and sold eggs. I worked in the chicken hatcheries and cattled and checked eggs and built fires for people. I babysit, raised rabbits and butchered them from the meat market. I was always doing something. Peddled papers.
Boy.
Always found something to do. Then when I was 18, I got that job at Camp 5. My uncle worked up there, and of course, Clay Berry and the superintendent knew my dad well and all that. And that was during the Depression, really, you know, in 34, rather. So I was lucky to get that job on the loading crew. But I was too late for it. I'd come back into camp at night, and I wouldn't even go to dinner. I'd just go crawl on my bunk, cork shoes and all. Tired me out. But that was when I took the second job, when they called me back up there to go to work, at what they called it night watch, and firing up these all that equipment in the morning for the crews. That was a good job because I had all day to go hunting and fishing. And they showed up at about 7:30, 7:45, and I was done until the quitting time. Do as I please. There was a bartender here in town, an Italian that was at the bar, let's see, the Village Bar. He used to have a bar out at Callison Bay. Dunovich?
I think it's Dunovich.
Dunovich? So. His uncle was fireman, and night watchman on another site, and we were about 4 miles apart. And sometimes when he'd have a Loki left there to fire by, he'd fire it up. He'd come over in the evening before he put it to bed, as we called it, you know. And we'd play cards. If I had it, I used to go down and visit him with the engine. That's all he had. We was careful we didn't blow the whistle so they could hear us 11 miles away down the bottom country, though. But I suppose they knew we did that quite often, but didn't say nothing. But it was an interesting job. And think of what else I might have missed in there. Shut it off from me. See?
There you go.
When the logging company had strict orders that there was no illegal hunting, you know, you weren't allowed to take your guns. And of course, I had a .22 pistol. I woodsman I packed all the time to like to wear belts out. And on weekends when the camp was shut down, if I left camp, the speeder would come up and get me Friday night after I had the engines put away. And then Sunday, if I got back before dark, Sunday afternoon, well, they'd have to run me up there. It was 10, 11 miles. I wasn't always 11 miles. The closest, I think, I was about 6 miles. And then as they logged, I got further. But the majority, I was around 9 to 11 miles above the camp. But being 19 and 20, you know, you could never get back early enough Sunday night to get a ride. You're 2 or 3 in the morning.
Running up the hill.
I'm hanging up the hill on track. Get there and follow up those things. But I never was late one time in all the years that I did that. But anyhow, one Sunday night in the summertime, the foreman that run me up, Jack Cole, they had a speeder, if you know what a railroad speeder is. It's just four wheels and an engine and the seat, so you sit on it with your feet facing off, you know, and the track's this way to you. And Jack says, "I'd like to have some venison." I said, "Well, get your rifle." So he went to his house and brought his rifle to me. And I'm sitting on the speeder holding this rifle, and in drove a car, and here it was the owners of Simpson Logging Company, Bill and Frank Reed. I knew them both, you know, and their dad, Mark Reed, was really the head guy. And such evening, and Jack had went back to his house or up to the office or something, Jack Cole, the foreman. Anyhow, they come there and thought they might as well take a ride up that nice evening, you know, through the logging works, you know. And they sat down beside me there on that thing, and yeah, I forget which was Jack or Bill, but one of them, or Mark, one of the reeds, Bill, or looked at me with that gun and said, what are you doing with the rifle? And I said, well, it's pretty hard to get a piece of meat without a gun, ain't it? And they just looked at me and grinned.
Did you get one?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how many times. And Clay Berry, the superintendent, used to bawl me out. He says, you know, you're not supposed to be hunting up here. But if he was in the woods at noon, he always came to my shack. And if I knew he was up there, I'd have a venison roast on in the oven or something. Boy, did he like it. They said, you know, you're not supposed to be hunting up here. Well, he treated me good. He saved me from getting pinched one time, too, with elk meat. And one Thanksgiving, by Jack Cole and Burge Adams, that I showed you there, they said, by gosh, we'd like to have some venison or some elk meat for Thanksgiving. So I again had Jack's rifle, and I shot two elk. I shot a cow and a nice young calf. And Burge and I brought it down with a push car, just a flat one, when we down the mountain. And it about ran over, so we had a hell of a time with that thing. But we eventually got to camp. But Simpson Rock had come to give all their employees a turkey for Thanksgiving. But if they wanted to hold it over to Christmas, they could get it then. So both the foreman and Jack and Burge said they wanted the elk meat and their turkey for Christmas. And Jack was telling me about the elk I gave him. It was the toughest thing he ever said. He says this, he exaggerates, I suppose. But he said his wife put a roast that big in the oven, and she roasted and roasted. And the longer it in there, the smaller it got and the tougher it got. Finally, she took it out and boiled it. Boiled it, and he said it still couldn't cut it, so he discussed. She threw it out to the dog, and he said he chewed on it and took it out and buried it. And I took the calf, the yearling, over to my mother's and stepdad's place, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Another little thing that happened, the Wainuchi River runs up through the place, and in the fall, the king salmon showed up. And way up above the logging works, 4 or 5 miles in the river, I was fishing. I discovered there was some king salmon in a deep hole. 3 or 4 nice big kings that couldn't bite, though. And I thought, well, about a week later, a boyfriend of mine showed up, Forrest Kelly, and I'll tell him about it. So he said, we'll take some dynamite and we'll go up and get a couple of fish. Well, those big logs, the boys can't get the choker around under them. So they have a powder monkey all the time, but all he does is blow choker holes. And he has powder, he cuts a stick of dynamite in half, puts a cap in it, and a fuse about that long. And then he has a vest around with a bigger box of powder. Each half stick has a little cap and fuse on it. And he has a long piece of pipe with a wooden handle. And he just comes to the log and runs underneath it, makes a little hole, and pokes a stick of powder, half a stick of powder in there, and just lights it and steps to one side and blows the hole so we can get the choker on it. He's the powder monkey. And so I just stopped at the shed up there where I used to unload the powder for him a lot of times too. I'd go down to the shed and haul, jump on the Loki and bring flat car and bring up boxes of powder. They run short. So this weekend, I just took 4 or 5 half sticks of powder and stuck in my shirt pocket, and Kelly and I went up there. But there must have been 15 or 20 big king salmon in the hole. And I said, well, we won't do that. You don't want to kill all them fish. But an open gravel bar was a bend in the river, and there was the hole in the open gravel bar. And the bank is about yay high with alders. And so I just lit my stick of powder and threw it way out in the gravel bar and make a big noise, you know, it don't hurt much. And Forrest Kelly thought, well, he'd put his underneath the roots of that alder that was hanging on him. They didn't watch the alder fall over. And he's nervous with powder. His stick was up here about above his head, you know, stuck in those roots. He got his match out and went to light that short fuse, and the match went out, and he got another. And about the third time, I stepped up behind him, took out my pistol. He stuck the match up there. And that Irishman went up in the air about as high as my head and came down. Took a swing at me. I had to run like 60.
Oh, it was terrible.
But it was fun.
It sounds like it.
Schaefer's Logging Company in Aberdeen, Hokum, logged at McClary. Schaefer's was, really. But they logged through that area. But they bought timber in the reserve of both Simpson Logging Company's Camp 5 where I worked. And then they were having a lawsuit over right-of-way. They had to go through a lot of Simpson's holdings, and Simpson didn't want them to log up there. They wanted it themselves. So they had surveyors going back and forth, and winter came along, and Simpson had a survey crew way up there surveying too. And camp shut down, and the surveyors left a bunch of stuff up there 12, 14 miles up in the mountains. And of course, there was a little forest, little lean-to shed that they were supposed to have left the stuff in. And so the superintendent said he'd pay me if I'd hike in and bring their instruments out. And this is snow and dead of winter and cold. And so I hiked up there, left about noon one day, and I hiked in. It was moonlight by the time I got up there, and colder and blazes. The river was froze over, and snow was about 10 inches deep, but froze hard. And I couldn't find a single thing that they left there. Their blankets and all that was good. Couldn't find nothing. So I had to follow. All it was there was a saw and sledge and wedge and axe and stuff that the forestry used. So I felled a little tree in front and chopped wood and built a fire in this lean-to, tipped the table over and spent the night behind that in the wall. I had tea with me. I always packed tea. I didn't pack coffee. I had a cup of tea that I made, but I didn't have no groceries. I figured there was stuff up there I could. So anyhow, I sitting there in the firelight and watching it, and this little 8x10 foot lean-to. And I noticed there was a watch hanging on a leather thong on a nail in there. And I got looking at that, it was about 10 feet from me, where I was in this here corner, and it was hanging across. And the fire would flare up good, and I was looking at it. Finally, I couldn't resist. I took my pistol out, took a careful aim, and I hit that watch right on the stem, and it just exploded. The face came off, and the back came off, and the guts fell out. And I got it and squeezed it all back together and rehung it on the nail. I felt better then, you know. And the next day, I hiked back to my camp and went down. Eventually, I went down to Camp 5 and left. The following fall, I came down on a weekend to leave Friday night and went in the office for a minute. And here was this survey gang that had been up there and left the stuff. They'd hid them. They didn't tell me they hid them from that place. So anyhow, then they had a big set of elk horns there. When I walked in, this one guy starts, "Hey, you're pretty careless when you leave your elk horns lay around." Before I could say anything, I looked over and the guy had pulled out his watch. He says, "Look what somebody did to my watch." And I felt good. I just got out of there. I never said a word.